Great. So first of all, thank you very much for the invitation. Very happy to be at Perimeter again. And so in fact, I'm going to be here the next 2 weeks. So I look forward to talking to people while I'm here. So what I thought I would do today is talk about three aspects of inflation that in some sense I feel cry out for UV completion. And that, of course, then makes it interesting to study these kind of aspects of inflation in the context of string theory. Because, of course, those are the kind of questions where you benefit most directly from having a theory like string theory where you can ask UV questions honestly. So just to have a little bit of review, of course, you all know that inflation is a period of accelerated expansion. And it basically predicts the large scale appearance of the universe. So it solves horizon flatness and monopole problems, and therefore explains why the universe is large, flat, and empty. And then on top of that, it explains fluctuations in the universe. So there are two types of fluctuations, fluctuations in the scalar density part, and those are now, of course, observed in CMB temperature fluctuations. And then fluctuations in a tensor or metric component, which we hope to observe as gravitational waves. And what inflation does, it predicts statistical features of those fluctuations. Yeah? So it predicts that the scalar fluctuations are nearly, but not exactly, scale invariant. For the simplest models, it predicts that it's approximately Gaussian. And it relates the amplitude of tensor fluctuations to the energy scale of inflation. Okay, so of course we all know it's a golden age of cosmology where we actually have started to measure those statistical properties of these fluctuations. And it never fails me to amaze me. It's amazing that if you look at the scales of these plots, that there are temperature fluctuations at the level of 10 to minus 5 that people are now routinely measuring. So in some sense, these temperature fluctuations, now people have good control over those measurements. And as I'm going to describe in the first half of my talk, the next kind of frontier is going to be to actually measure polarization states of this early radiation. Okay, so these observations in combination with observations of large scale structure have led to a standard model of cosmology. Yeah, so the observations tell us that that the basic picture of a homogeneous backgrounds with small fluctuations basically works. The homogeneous background is characterized by a few parameters. It basically tells us that the universe is filled with atoms, dark matter, and dark energy. And it tells us the rough proportions of these constituents. Okay. It also tells us that there are small fluctuations in the density field, and those fluctuations are characterized by an amplitude and a scale dependence. And of course, the amplitude has securely been measured. The indications now for a non-trivial deviation from scale invariance, and these two parameters will be part of my talk that haven't been measured but are going to be crucial to look out for in the future, I would think. So the prediction, as I mentioned, the predictions for those fluctuations is that they're nearly scale invariant, adiabatic, and Gaussian. And this is the first time that in my talk I actually added a question mark to that Gaussian prediction. Because as you're going to hear in the later half of this week, there's going to be a workshop discussing to what degree that simplest prediction of inflation is reflected in the data. Yeah? Okay, so then these observations have led to theoretical questions. And as far as the background evolution is concerned, the question is, what is the dark matter? What is the dark energy? And as far as these the fluctuations go, the question is, what produced those early fluctuations? And so for the purpose of this talk, I'm going to assume that there was some period of inflationary expansion. And two questions that then immediately arise is, what is the actual shape of the inflationary potential? And how to relate the shape of that potential energy function to some microscopic physics. And the second question is, what is the amplitude of gravitational waves? And as I'm going to try to convince you, is that the amplitude of gravitation, first of all, it's going to be strongly constrained by near future data. Yeah? And models that produce an observable signal require proper UV understanding. Yeah? So in some sense, these measurements are almost a unique opportunity in the theory and observations of inflation to actually use it to constrain microphysical aspects. Okay, so in today's talks, I want to be a little bit more specific and study a concrete model of string inflation. And that's going to be the model of Wobbe-Debrin inflation. And in that context, I'm going to try to understand predictions for the energy function for the inflaton and predictions for the amplitude of gravitational waves. So my talk is roughly going to divide into two parts, but in the first half, I'm going to talk about the expected amplitude for these models, amplitude of tensor fluctuations. In the second half, I'm going to talk about recent progress in actually computing this this potential function. Okay, so my rough outline is the following. So in the first half, I'm going to describe how a high amplitude of gravitational wave is related to field excursions of the inflaton field. And then going to very briefly review inflationary models in string theory. I'm going to describe in a little bit more detail Wobbe-Debrin inflation. And then for Wobbe-Debrin inflation, I'm going to derive two things. I'm going to derive a microscopic limit on the amplitude of tensors. And then I'm going to derive an explicit realization of, or explicit derivation of the inflaton potential for that scenario. And then I'm going to have some conclusions. So this is, I should mention, this is based on work that I did mostly with people at Princeton. So last year that was with Leah McAllister, who's now at Cornell, then Igor Klebanov, Anatoly Dimaski, who's now at Stanford, also a paper with Juan Malasina at the Institute, and then Arvind Murugan, who's a grad student at Princeton. And then more recently, we have been discussing also with Shamit Kashru some extensions of this. So if I have time, I'm going to talk about these new things as well. Yeah. Okay. So I want to describe this interesting relation between the size of gravitational waves and the field excursions of the inflaton field. And the derivation is actually very simple. So of course, we all know that quantum fluctuations during in a de Sitter phase source fluctuations in both the tensor and the scalar sector. And tensor fluctuations basically just mean fluctuations in a metric component. And so these fluctuations, these de Sitter fluctuations just scale as the Hubble constant during inflation. So the power spectrum for tensor fluctuation then just scales as the Hubble constant squared over the Planck mass squared. Yeah? And it's important that this is the four-dimensional Planck mass. And computing this, the scalar power spectrum is almost as simple. Yeah? So again, there, for scalar fluctuations, there are fluctuations in the inflaton value itself. Yeah? So the inflaton field has a classical evolution down the potential energy function. And then superimposed on that, there will be small quantum fluctuations. And those small quantum fluctuations scale with the Hubble parameter. Yeah? And so what that means is that different parts of the universe, different spatially separated parts of the universe will have different values for the inflaton field. So inflation will end at slightly different times for different parts of the universe. And so this leads up to a time delay of the end of inflation for different regions of the universe. And that time delay will mean that the fluctuations in the field will be converted into fluctuations in the energy density, because reheating basically takes part at slightly different times in different places. So that leads to this time delay conversion factor in addition to just the simple visitor fluctuations imposed on the field. Yeah? So we have then these two power spectra, and what is important for observations is the ratio of the two. Yeah? It's the ratio of the tensor power spectrum to the scalar power spectrum. And so if you normalize these things properly, you find that there's a one-to-one correspondence between the evolution of the field in terms of the number of e-folds, yeah, where the number of e-folds I've defined here, yeah, and the so-called tensor to scalar ratio. So this is assumed.
And the perturbations are produced by the e-folds.
That's true. That's true. Yeah. We can also, you know, relatively what we can talk about generalizations of that, what happens when you have multiple fields. For a lot of multiple field models, you know, there's an effective description that is like this. For some multi-field ones, there is. So here, so to be simple, I'm assuming a single field for the background inflaton, and fluctuations in that field will be compared to those fluctuations. Okay. So here I'm reproducing this relation. Important point being, again, that the value of the tensor to scalar ratio is given by this, the derivative of the field with respect to number of e-folds. So what one can then do immediately is just integrate that value from the end of inflation to some some field value phi star, where by star I'm always going to indicate observable scales. So those are CMB or large scale structure scales. So for concreteness, maybe let's just imagine CMB scales. And those scales happen, you know, about 60 e-folds before the end of inflation. And so I'm integrating this tensor to scalar ratio for about 60 e-folds from phi n to phi star. And what Leith then found in 96 already, I think, is that with some mild assumption, this can then be related to a direct correspondence between the measured inflaton, or the measurable inflaton value at CMB scales and the field evolution from that time to the end of inflation. So that's what I'm calling delta phi here. Yeah. And so this is then, and in fact, he related this to an inequality, where so the maximal amplitude of gravitational waves that you can expect is determined by the maximal evolution of the field.
Yeah. R is a smooth function of phi.
Yeah, it does in some sense. Yeah. So you can actually constrain it. But so here I indicated that R can evolve as a number, you know, with time between when we observe it and between CMB scales and the end of inflation, basically.
So it evolves very fast.
Like if it evolves very fast and in a very particular way, then this would loosen up slightly. But in slow roll models, for example, the evolution of R is constrained. Yeah? So second order and slow roll. This is a little bit early. So we of course, you know, consider this in a little bit more detail. And so what would have to happen is that R is large on CMB scales and then drafts rapidly to some small value. So that then the integrated effect is actually small, although you're observing a large value 60 e-folds before the end. Yeah? So if you construct a model that does that, yeah, starting with a large value of R and then drops rapidly and stays small, that has a chance of getting around this a little. Yeah, a little bit. If R evolves smoothly, then that would.
Either canonical kinetic
term
or like something like
DBI,
it doesn't hold for general.
It does hold for DBI.
Yeah, for DBI it does, but in general
exactly.
For non-canonical.
I can show, I mean, you probably know, I can show you the derivation. If you assume a general P of X function, then there will be a correction which is, which goes like the speed of sound for these non-canonical models at P, comma X. So P of X by, you know, often is used to parameterize, and here X is, I should say, X is roughly 5 squared. Just a canonical kinetic term. So this function for simple slow roll models would look like this. So if you assume, you know, that you allow this function to be have an arbitrary shape, or functional dependence on x, you get this correction to this result. What happens for slow roll models is that CS is actually 1, and p comma x is also 1. Yeah. And what happens for DBI is that they're separately not one, but the product of the two is one. And it's the product of the two that matters. So this is, of course, well known, that the only point I want to make is that this is an interesting constraint if you had some microscopic way of constraining this field range. Because then that microscopic calculation, rather model independently, tells you what amplitude of rotation waves to expect. In an indirect way, you know, usually, you know, another way of getting to the gravitational wave amplitude is to calculate, you know, with high precision the actual slope of the potential. It turns out that this amplitude is related to the first derivative of the inflationary potential, and typically, as I'm going to show in the second half, these computations are hard, and you know, you have a hard time convincing yourself that you have that you really have a robust prediction for the first derivative of the potential. Whereas this computation, you know, as I'm going to show, is purely geometrical, and therefore less susceptible, you know, to uncertainties about the actual potential function. So then what if we actually do see tensors? What would that imply? Yeah. So I should mention the current bound on tensors is of order 40%. Yeah. So the ratio of tensor to scalar amplitude is about has to be less than 40% to be in agreement with the current data, and I think there seems to be some consensus that what is realistically observable is a tensor amplitude which is bigger than 1. If that, this amplitude happens to be less than 1, then it seems that the signal is grounded in astrophysical graph foregrounds forever. OK, so we want to keep this value here in mind, where an observable amplitude means more than 1% tensor to scalar ratio. OK, so then two pieces of information result from a measurement of R. Of course, the first piece of information is the one that is most often appreciated, which is that it automatically gives you the energy scale of inflation. So if you take the measured amplitude of scalar perturbations, if you take the approximation that the Hubble parameter, yeah, from the Friedmann equation, that the Hubble squared scales as the energy function, then you find this relation between the tensor to scalar ratio and the energy scale of inflation. Yeah? So what that means is that a large tensor to scalar ratio means a large energy scale for inflation. And as I just emphasized, the second implication is that there had to be super Planckian field variation. Yeah? So the field has to evolve over more than a Planck distance if tensors are to be observable. And in particular, you know, everybody's favorite inflationary model, m squared phi squared, requires that the inflaton field evolves over 15 times the Planck mass. And that's just because in order to get enough E fields, you have to, you know, start at a high value for
fields, like in this inflation, then each of them can move by a little bit.
Exactly. So this constraint is then on the effective evolution of, you know, n of these fields. And in fact, you win by a square root n for n fields. Mm-hmm. Yeah? And that's in fact what is done in, you know, in inflation. We have n axions. And each of the axions is evolving, is displaced from the minimum, then evolves towards the minimum. Each displacement is less than the Planck distance, but n of them collectively can act like an effective m squared phi squared, which has this property. What they find there is that they have to, you know, they have to actually use 1,000 axions. So then you can, and then you have to worry about the collective evolution of, you know, 1,000 axions and initial conditions and copies and things like that. Okay. Okay, so again, as I said, you know, the observable tensors require that the inflaton field evolves over more than the Planck distance, and at the same time, the potential has to be controllably flat. Yeah. And so the question I want to pose is whether that is consistent in a microscopic theory like string theory. Yeah. So in the literature, there have been a number of controversial effective field theory arguments that even propose, you know, that even at the level of effective field theory, there's some concern of about having large field variation while keeping the potential controllably flat. But those arguments are very controversial and UV sensitive, I would say. And so what I want to do here is to do something very different from the effective field theory argument, should actually just in the concrete string theory setup compute that field variation. And we're going to see that it's not going to be susceptible to all the uncertainties that go into these kind of arguments. So any questions on this first topic? OK. So very, very briefly, just a review of inflation and string theory. Of course, we all know that from the four-dimensional effective field theory point of view, there will be moduli in string theory, the dilaton, complex structure, Kähler moduli, and positions of d-brains. And the only point I want to make here is that these moduli fields can be both a blessing and a curse, of course. It can be a blessing if one wants to describe inflationary dynamics or, you know, evolving dark energy, where cosmologists actually, you know, have made a living out of, you know, proposing scalar fields with potentials and looking for the cosmological implications. So, of course, you know, a natural idea was to use those moduli fields to explain some of these cosmologically on formological models from cosmology. But they, of course, they're also a curse because if moduli aren't fixed, they're typically bad news. So if they don't do the job, if they don't actually have the evolution which is just right to explain inflation or dark energy, then they're usually troublesome and spoil the cosmological or spoil the background cosmology or, you know, low energy physics. Evolution of coupling constants, you know, Newton's constant, fine structure constant. All these effective constants usually depend on the modular fields, and we know that they don't vary strongly in time. So typically what one wants is one wants to have most of these moduli fields fixed. And the only ones that aren't fixed are the ones that are with suitable potential shapes to explain inflation or dark energy. And of course, recently moduli stabilization was achieved in a concrete setting in string theory. So this is the setting that I'm going to use for the rest of the talk by Kashyap, Kalash, Linde, and Trivedi, where moduli is stabilized by fluxes and non-perturbative effects on rat brains. Yeah? So the details of this are going to be more important in the second half of my talk. I just wanted to outline this here. And then the basic idea simply is, if you want to describe dynamics of moduli, is that there are two logical possibilities, and they're often classified as closed string models and open string models. Or in a more qualitative sense, it's dynamics of or in the extra dimensions. Yeah? So it's a time evolution of the extra dimensions themselves, yeah, will manifest itself as, you know, an inflationary energy in the 4D space time, or an energy density moving through the extra dimensional space also will be perceived as the same in the effective 4D description. Yeah? And so dynamics of the extra dimension typically is characterized by these types of models, you know, goes by the names of racetrack, Taylor moduli, roulette inflation. And then here I want to focus on open string models, where the role of the inflaton field is played by the position of an inflaton field, and that position evolves through the extra dimensional space. Yeah, and then in particular, there have been various incarnations of that idea. I'm going to focus on the specific realization of warp brain, anti brain. So this is a sketch of the setup. So here, this is 6D spacetime, where one has a bulk compactification manifold in a local warp throat region. And so the D3 brain and the anti D3 brain is spacetime filling, so they appear point-like. They appear point-like in the extra-dimensional space. So, and then the idea is that there will be a force between the two, yeah, that is characterized by a potential energy function. And the distance between the two is going to be the serves as the inflaton field. Yeah. Okay, so as I mentioned, in these KKLT compactifications, there naturally are fluxes in order to stabilize the complex structure moduli. And so so without adding extra further ingredients, you know, one can look at back reaction of these fluxes on the background geometry, and one generically finds these warp throat regions. And so what we want to study here from concreteness is, you know, the evolution of the brain inside that locally warped region. And so there are a couple of advantages of the throat are that the warping suppresses the force between the brain and the anti-brain. And because it, so what one finds actually, if one in embeds this system into a flat space, one finds that the force between the two is too strong to source inflation. But then what KKLMT showed is that warping suppresses the force and actually allows an exponentially flat potential. So at zeroth order, the potential shape actually looks something like this when KKLMT computed it. Yeah? And so this flattening at a large values of R here is an effect that is suppressed that arises due to warping suppression. Then for certain particle physics relations, you know, it might be beneficial to have an explanation for hierarchies of scales. And so this kind of geometry naturally is a string theory realization of Randall syndrome. And for our purposes, most importantly, it's going to be that this is a local model that has an explicit metric. Yeah? And so that makes it very computable and makes it a suitable lamppost to actually address very concrete questions about the force between these two objects, compactification effects, and things like this. So this should be contrasted to the general case where Calabi-Yau metrics, of course, are not known. Okay. So any questions on the basic setup? So this is, yeah, so what the setup we're working is standard KKLMT scenario with no extra ingredients. So we just want to ask, you know, what are the actual predictions of that scenario for the tensor amplitude and the inflaton potential? So in this part, I want to address the tensor amplitude. And as I explained, the way I want to do this is by computing the range of the field.
So here, just a little bit more about the geometry. So this local warp geometry has the following metric. Yeah? So it's also described as a warped cone, because it has a cone-like structure in the 6D spacetime. And then there's a warp factor that relates this, you know, the 4D part and the 6D part.
And the warp factor, you know, in an approximate, in the regime of large radius, it takes this approximate value. It turns out that actually, you know, generalizing this to more exact warp factors doesn't change the argument at all. And the important thing is here, you know, the scaling. The scaling of the warp factor is basically explained as. I probably don't want to get into it too much, but it's just basically explained by, you know, the scaling of the Green's function in a 6D space, which goes as 1/r⁴. And so the overall warping scale R here is determined by two more constants, yeah, or three. So here I've defined for convenience the tension of a three brain. So this basically just combines factors of alpha prime and G prime. And then the scaling goes as the number of integer flux that sources this warp region, yeah, capital N, and the volume of the base manifold. So one should imagine a five-dimensional base manifold here. And this is the dimensionless volume, which typically just is going to be, you know, a factor of order of pi cubed. But
So you should imagine that this, of course, is attached to some bulk region.
Right. So the bound of the range that you're going to derive is only within that.
Exactly. So if you could get extra inflation from this region, the bound would relax a little bit. But typically, you wouldn't imagine. I mean, the warping basically, you know, achieves flattening of the potential. Generically, the potential you wouldn't expect to be flat in this outer region here. But I'm actually going to derive the bound in detail, and you're going to see all the assumptions that go in there. Yeah. So one of the assumptions is all of the inflation is happening in this region. The region is cut off by some UV scale. Yeah. And then you attach a bulk region.
So capital R and R max.
They're approximately the same. Okay. They're approximately the same. But they don't have to be. That's why I could have called this capital R. And often that's what is done. It turns out that all these things actually, when we derive the bond, cancel out. So for generality, because there might be a small difference between capital R and R max, just to show that it doesn't matter, you know, I keep this if this appears R max.
What's going to be G mu nu dx mu dx
mu? What that is going to be?
Right. Going
to
be a flat of the
asymmetric. So, strictly speaking, it should be a asymmetric. Yeah. And so, for this argument, this doesn't affect things at all. It's going to affect things in the second half when we talk about the ether problem. Yeah. And I know that you did the analysis using, you know, the zipper slice here. We should talk about that later. But here, really, we're looking at the evolution in this part of the metric.
So then what one does is one basically dimensionally reduces the action using that metric. Yeah? And, you know, one finds this important relation between, you know, a 10-dimensional mass scale and the 4-dimensional Planck mass. And the two are related by the 6-dimensional volume. Importantly, the 6-dimensional warp volume. So that's an integral of the warp factor over the 6-dimensional space. And here, M10, you know, again, combines, you know, certain combinations of G string and alpha prime. And again, conveniently, it can also be written in terms of the tension of the three brain. So then, as I mentioned, this six-dimensional volume can be split up into a contribution that comes from the throat region. Yeah? So that's the one that Justin was talking about. And then there's an extra contribution coming from the bulk. Yeah? And this is under good control because, you know, we have an explicit metric and an explicit warp factor for that region. So you can actually, you know, compute the integral and get a precise functional value here. This is less well known and hard to compute. Yeah? So what we do is we want to be conservative and actually drop this bulk part and just use the throat volume as a lower limit estimate for the total volume. Yeah? But since we're interested in the field range in units of the Planck mass, yeah, this minimal, a lower bound on the Planck mass will give you an upper limit on the field evolution. Yeah? So this is very conservative, and including some estimate of the bulk volume, yeah, will only strengthen the bulk. Yeah? So one should keep this in mind when one finds, you know, that the bound can be marginally satisfied. Because then one has to go back and see, you know, I was actually very generous here dropping the bulk volume. Yeah? So it's not good enough just to marginally satisfy that bound. One has to actually, you know, satisfy it parametrically in some sense.
Compared to the bulk is the throat volume?
How small compared to the bulk? Well, it's not specified. So it could be, you know, they could be of the same order. There could be much more volume in the bulk than in the throat region. If that's the case, then this is, you know, this is very generous to make this kind of approximation. So this is just saying this again, that, you know, we get a conservative estimate by ignoring the bulk volume and just computing the throat volume. And then just using the line element from the previous page, you know, I get the following result. And it will depend on R max squared, and it depends on capital N and P3. Okay? So then one gets a lower bound on the four-dimensional Planck mass, which is given by these microscopic parameters.
Sorry, what happened to capital R?
So for capital R, I substituted this scaling relation.
Let me make sure I understand. So it's conservative in the sense that you're considering effectively lower in Planck by restricting the volume.
So then if I compute the range in Planck units, you know, I will get a larger value than I would have got.
Yeah, but on the other hand, you are restricting the range of the field can take. So
That's true.
It's both conservative and
But you will see that this.
It depends on what
But the range typically scales as, you know, one power of length. This is going to be actually crucial to actually interpreting also.
Yeah.
And the volume it scales as six powers of the length. So this is actually one of the reasons why one loses in this scale. I'm giving away a little bit of the punchline, but naively you would think, you know, you could make this throat longer and longer, and then you get larger and larger range in terms of distance between the brains. Yeah. But what happens is you have to take into account that your ruler changes, the Planck mass changes, and it changes faster than your linear expansion changes. Yeah. Now, it actually turns out that having a short throat gives you a larger range of canonical Planck units. Yeah. Well, naively, you would have thought, you know, just keeping the Planck mass fixed, you know, you would have thought just making the throat longer and longer will give you a larger and larger range.
But can I say something? So you fix a four-dimensional Planck mass?
No, we're not. That's the point.
You're not.
We're not. So as you're dialing up the throat volume, the four-dimensional Planck mass adjusts and changes.
But the ten-dimensional Planck mass is.
The ten-dimensional Planck mass
is fixed.
That's the point. Yeah. Okay, so there's this lower limit on the four-dimensional Planck mass. Basically, increasing the size of the throat means increasing R max and increasing N. Yeah, both of these, you know, increase the lower limit on the Planck mass. And then, as you just said, you know, I'm cutting off the range of the inflaton field at R max. Yeah, and it turns out that if you take the ratio of the two, it becomes independent of all these constants, yeah, and only depends on this capital N integer. Yeah, so we get this very simple relation where the range of the field in Planck units is given basically by this flux integer capital N.
Going for the common story. So here now you're basically canonically normalizing the scalar, which is this distance between the brains.
But yeah, that's why I had to include this T3 here.
So to what extent is this known in the sense that you can imagine if you have large correction to Taylor potential, then maybe it's not a question. Sure. Now maybe you could imagine that if somehow that field ended up with a huge coefficient in the kinetic term, that would change your conclusions.
I think that might be related to what we were just talking about.
Right.
Yeah. So one way of parameterizing these large corrections to the kinetic, yeah, is to allow this function, this.
How do you say with this general story?
With this general story.
Sorry, you're right.
So typically, what people are assuming that. So there are two ways I could be defining this. Yeah. It turns out this is the canonical field, even if I'm talking about DBI. Yeah. So what you would have to be talking about is something that is very different from both the slow world limit and the relativistic group. You know, DBI. So I'm not quite sure what that would imply.
Yes.
But, so this certainly applies in both of these limits that we. So in some sense, if you, you know, if you trust that the brain dynamics is determined by the DBI action, then this normalization just follows by the normalization. You know, this T3, in fact, just comes from the overall normalization of the brain action.
The first relationship. So that's the 4D Planck mass at the end of inflation, or at the beginning, or. But you said it's not. You're not fixing the 4D Planck mass. So
no. Well, in reality, of course, it's fixed. I'm saying if in your mind you were to expand the throat.
But that's not what happened. At the time, the 4D Planck mass.
Sorry. It's a thought experiment.
But it could change in time.
It will actually change very slightly in time, because actually as the brain moves, mm-hmm. we'll talk about that a little bit in the second half. As the brain moves, it backreacts on the geometry a little bit. It changes the overall volume very slightly.
So I have a question for that. So suppose you were to throw n of these d brains, so you try to do something like assisted inflation.
Yeah.
So would the same story hold, that you would get a square root of n enhancement?
Yeah. People in fact tried that.
Okay. But then you're probably constrained by this back reaction story?
You're constrained by back, exactly. So it turns out, yeah, exactly. You win by a square root of n. So you're just looking at this relation. So say you have little n, the total number of you know, brains that you're trying to use for the assistance effect. Yeah. Then what you get is you get twice square root little n over big N. Mm-hmm. But there's a back reaction constraint that little n cannot be bigger than large n. You know, otherwise, they would completely distort your background geometry.
Okay.
There's no good sense in which you can treat them as probes. You know, if little n becomes comparable to capital. So this would still not help you to extend this range in that control regime. So we get this bound, and in fact, I'm not sure if I mentioned, but you know, consistency of the supergravity approximation. Yeah. So the fact that you know all curvatures in the space have to be you know small compared to strain scale requires that this capital N value is much bigger than 1. Yeah. And in fact, also it requires to be able to be talking about a warped region in the first place. Yeah. Since the warping is sourced by this flux coefficient. Yeah. So a number of reasons to expect you know that in a controlled regime you want this integer to be large. But that then implies that the field value is much less than it is with Planck mass. Yeah. So from that simple argument, I would argue that you know observable cancels are unlikely from brain inflation. Okay. So then you know just to emphasize that you know we didn't require any genericity arguments. Yeah. So you didn't have to say it would be very fine tuned to have a flat potential over a large range or anything like that. But it was just purely a geometrical argument about the inflation field range. And also, as I mentioned before, that the naive expectation that longer throats will have a longer field range is actually not true if you consider rescaling of the Planck mass. So it turns out, you know, you want this throat actually to be as short as possible in order to have the maximal field range. But then, you know, at some point, you know, you just can't be talking about the throat anymore because it gets too small.
Much larger than the volume of the throat, then probably that effect is not super important.
So,
if the volume of the bulk, say it's much larger than the volume of the throat, then the rescaling of the four-dimensional amplitude is not that big issue if you say make the throat longer and longer. So,
but then, yeah, but then
that is
true. But basically, what would then happen is that what I'm talking about is a bound that is much lower than what the real bound is. So I'm talking about the rescaling of this lower bound. But if I had included the bulk volume, I would have had a much stronger constraint.
I have another question. So in terms of there's nothing. Are you restrained for 4D Planck mass close? I mean, not changing much. Of all the things in your inequality, that seems like the one that is the least measured during inflation. So I mean, if you have the whole volume, I mean, this is really
well, it affects the slow roll parameters. So if you have the Planck mass changing, you can always define that I think a constant Planck mass and you know and account for the change in it. You know, you can go to Einstein frame where the Planck mass is fixed by definition, and then basically any change in the Planck mass that you're talking about would be reflected in a change in the potential shape.
So I think what would happen is just that you would violate slow roll if the plan mass is changing too quickly.
In that
string frame.
Right, but I mean, if you're having something like a compression where the character violating slow roll and the string frame potential to set by relativistic.
So I agree. I think the simplest thing to do would just be, go to, not talking about the evolution of string frame, but going to Einstein frame, see how the potential shape changes, and then just analyze the evolution with a, modified potential. But I don't think it affects this.
Oh no, but the geometry, like, but you're saying this is a volume building. Which framing is a volume building constraint, right?
Yeah. Well, that's how I give the simple interpretation.
I have a very nice question. So things like the number of E4s and the scalar tensor ratio, are these frame dependent or frame independent? Does it matter which frame you're working in, string frame or Einstein frame?
Well, to not confuse yourself, I will just go to Einstein frame.
But is there a sense in which some frame being more canonical than some other?
I think the evolution is just simpler to see in Einstein frame. And, it surely will be different. You have a different metric, so I'm not sure. If you're calculating number of E4s, you might be calculating in that a different metric.
Usually, in this work, Strode's dilaton doesn't change much. Anyway.
No.
So there is not a big difference.
Yeah, the effect will be small. I mean, yeah, that's also true. I think, especially if you want the effect to be so small that it doesn't spoil your slow roll in Einstein frame, that will constrain you to seeing
that. When I say that the number of E4s is greater than 60 or whatever, should I be working in Einstein frame or?
Yeah. So when you see expressions for the slow roll parameter, those are Einstein frame expressions, and the field is canonically normalized, I think.
So suppose is the back reaction necessarily a big problem? Like suppose you were to throw a large number of E-brains, and then the throw somehow changes the function of time as this happens, and I guess it's related to some of the questions that were asked earlier. Is it just because we don't know?
I think it's more for you lose computational control. So it is true that if you wanted to argue, why just don't make this throw minimally warped? So I make this capital N integer, very small. So say I want to be talking about n values that are order tens or smaller, and then throwing a lot of stuff in there. Then I think the burden is still then on you to actually prove that this can give you something nice. It's not guaranteed. I mean, I'm not showing here that I think that it's impossible. It's just I think it's unlikely, and you will then actually have to. Yeah, actually would have to show that you can actually control this.
So the concern that I have is that you have a definition of Planck mass.
Yeah.
And it's not clear to me that that's the same thing as people measure today in the lab. And there could be something happening from the end of inflation till today, which changes the effective four-dimensional Planck mass. And that could be the change in the geometry of the ten-dimensional, the whole. Extra dimensions. The volume, V6, that could change at some point, right? After the end of inflation, for example.
Yeah.
And then that changes the four dimensional Planck mass.
I don't think it can do something dramatic. I mean, then you have to become.
But you have to fine tune that just prove, somehow the modular error fixed during inflation. Of course, that's a short period of time. Then so you're just saying, as the modular start running.
Yeah, at the end of during reheating or at some point. So maybe we'd have no observables really to.
Right, but sure, you can have that. And automatically just turn it on and been running on G already. And so you just say, that's just not working.
Not today, just sometime from the end of when we have no observables, basically. But okay, so that's really marginal.
I don't think that affects this either, because. So what you're imagining, if I understand correctly, is that the tank mass is fixed during inflation. And then something crazy happens after reheating to today. So then actually the Planck mass that was relevant during inflation is different from what we measured back. But I don't really talk about the measurement. I mean, it's still that the slow roll parameters that are defined for inflation are determined by that particular Planck mass, valid during inflation. And this relation between the tensor and the scalar ratio during inflation and the field evolution is for that Planck mass. not for the measured one. Then. But quite generally, I find it hard to imagine that they're very different. Okay. So I also have some comments about how this range actually also gives a very restricted bound on the DBR limit for that kind of model. But in the interest of time, maybe I skip over this and get to the second half of that. So if people are interested in that, they should ask me. And especially in the context of observing non-Gaussian, it's interesting that that non-Gaussian anti bound for DBI actually runs into conflict with that microscopic field range bound. So unfortunately, I don't have time to go through it in detail. Let me just say that if you want, non-Gaussian anti typically is parameterized by this FNN parameter. So the relativistic limit of brain motion in that same setup is interesting, both because it alleviates the fine-tuning problem of the potential, as Mark was mentioning, and it also produces observably large non-Gaussian. And in fact, actually, what we proved is that in these concrete settings, if you want to restrict the Planck mass to be less than M Planck by this microscopic limit, then that automatically implies that you're producing, in fact, too much non-Gaussian. So even today, with weak constraints on non-Gaussianity, you rule out this realization. So I'm happy to describe this in more detail if people are interested.
I just had one question. So that FNL that you wrote there, that's a local FNL.
No, it should be. Yeah, no, it should be equilateral, and there should be 300. But what are the magnitudes? So actually, what one finds is actually that this bound is valid by a factor of 10^7. Yeah, or more. So I'm not. Yeah. And if I show you the detailed derivation, you'll see this is very. There's not even arguing about. It turns out that for this relativistic DBR limit, this parameter n that I was talking about earlier, in order to get the correct normalization of density fluctuation, this parameter has to be 10^14. So there are some problems, in explaining how to realize 10^14 in a real compact application. But even if you allow that, that then means that the field variation has to be tiny. But in order to get So parametrically, in order to get FNLs which are suppressed by order below values of hundreds, you require that the field evolution is bigger than of order the Planck mass. But since this n value actually restricts the Planck mass, the field evolution will be less than 10^-7 times the Planck mass.
That only means that we cannot observe gravity waves, doesn't rule out the model, right?
What? Sorry?
If all this bound, if it's violated, if phi is, for example, much less than M1, then all you mean is that.
No, it means that if phi is less than M1, it means that FNL that you should predict for these models is bigger than 100. Much bigger. So there's a in DBI, it's interesting for the simplest realizations, there's a correlation between the value of R and FNL. In order to suppress FNL to a small value, you have to have large R. Or a large field evolution. The relation is more directly actually between the field evolution and then R is implied by the field evolution. So that was actually exciting because originally, before we discussed this bound, it would have meant that you're predicting to see both for DBI inflation. You're predicting to see R, and then that implies directly that FNL is large enough to do so. Okay. So just two implications of the field range bound are that I think it makes detectable tensors unlikely, and it rules out the simplest realizations of DBI inflation. So all the realizations that are based on this general setting that I was describing. If one surveys the literature of spring inflation models, one can very easily derive similar field range bounds for most deep brain inflation models, also for most closed spring models. And possible exceptions here is if instead of D3 brain, one uses wrapped higher dimensional brains. So what people have tried is, they have tried to use 5 brains and 7 brains and wrap them on lower dimensional cycle and then look at the evolution of those objects. It's not quite clear, how severe back reaction is in those kind of examples. But that's an interesting possibility that people have studied. And another possibility is what we talked about already, is inflation, the use of order thousands axions.
where each axion field, you know, evolves by a small distance, but collectively they have a large field variation. But again, also that somehow works at the limit of control. What people find is that the compactification geometry has to be of order string scale, I think. So there's also questions about how controlled these kind of models are. So from these simple examples, one can then ask, you know, whether large field inflation can be realized in a consistent string compactification. Yeah, today there's no, you know, consistent model that actually achieves that in a satisfactory way. But since, you know, in the future, of course, we will have constraints and maybe even measurements of R, it's going to be interesting to see whether there are corners of string compactification spaces that naturally allows such things to happen. And so I don't want to generalize, you know, a lot from the simple example that I was giving, just to point out that in that simple example, I think it was very clear that this is not possible. Okay, so any questions on that first talk? So I'm a bit worried because I have a whole another half and it's almost time. So I'm going to try to go through this a little bit schematically in maybe 15 minutes. Yeah, that's okay. Okay. So what I want to talk about here is something more challenging. Is actually, you know, getting some handle on the actual shape of the inflaton potential. So whereas in comparison, the first calculation, of course, was simple because it was purely geometrically and you didn't have to worry about detailed effects of computing the actual shape. So the general philosophy here is to start from an honest string compactification, where one specifies microscopic input data, yeah, discrete input data, which is, you know, specifying the geometry of the background space, specifying the, you know, the types and amount of brains that are present, specifying the type and amounts of fluxes. And then the challenge is to go from that discrete microscopic input to an effective 4D Lagrangian. Yeah? And in that effective Lagrangian, one can then study the evolution of moduli fields and, you know, in principle also compute the moduli potential for the inflaton field. So of course we know, you know, then so here I'm trying to indicate the space of all 4D Lagrangians. Yeah? There will be a subspace of Lagrangians that are suitable for inflation, yeah, that one can tune to allow inflation. And the question is, you know, what part of that subspace is actually populated by consistent models from string theory. Yeah? So as I suggested, you know, maybe there's a possibility that there's a distinction between large and small field models in string theory. Yeah? That string theory might only populate reliably the small field sector. Well, those are the kind of things that one would like to establish in this kind of philosophy. And then after one has a concrete handle of this, you know, I think it becomes, only then it becomes really interesting to make detailed statements about actual observables. Okay, so my personal timeline for this then would be that the short-term goal is to provide an existence proof, yeah, of the kind that I'm going to describe in a second. Midterm, one would like to classify all possible inflationary models in string theory, as I was just describing, understand microscopic constraint and naturalness issues in these frameworks. And then finally, one would like to compute. I haven't worked this one out yet, but maybe, yeah. So the basic point is that the hard part is not to find the flat potential, but the hard part is to show that there's actually deep potential and that it survives, you know, scrutinizing possible correction terms. So it's easy enough, you know, to find a moduli field where looking just at a part of the potential, you know, it naively looks flat. And in the KKMT example, you know, that would be looking at just the interaction of the brain and the anti-brain in a warp background. That looks exponentially flat. But then in order to show that the model is robust, one has to understand gravity corrections in up to dimension 6. So if imagine you start off with a potential V of 5. One has to have perfect control over these corrections to be able to assess whether the potential remains flat. And in particular, one has to worry about all corrections that induce corrections to the inflaton mass that are of order Hubble. And those are basically corrections to the second slow roll parameter eta, which are of order 1. Yeah. So if one can argue convincingly that all other corrections that one hasn't accounted for are parametrically suppressed, yeah, and give you corrections for the curvature of the potential, which are much less than 1. then I would call that satisfactory. Yeah? So for a controllable model, one needs to show that all these dangerous corrections here are either completely absent or suppressed, or that they cancel against each other. Yeah? And then, of course, you know, as this is indicating, this requires some knowledge of Planck scale physics.
I agree with you that it was a case of beta problem. Again, at least in the setup that you are doing, which is inflation, far away from the UV and the infrared end, I think this is a problem that, and you insist on using supergravity approximation, you can establish this within a, you know, classical high-dimensional gravity, the database. But so by saying that I need to know Planck scale physics of quantum gravity to, you know, to establish that eta is large.
No, not to establish that it's not large. So it's true that there could be classical corrections that make it large.
Right.
In addition, there could be quantum corrections that make it large.
Right.
And those are some of the corrections that I'm going to talk about. Yeah. The eta problem can arise even at the, you know, at the classical level, of course. Yeah. I agree. Here I'm trying to argue the opposite. Intro wants to argue that eta can be small. Yeah. So the basic example here to illustrate this is, you know, again, is brain inflation. So before one stabilizes the moduli, the potential is exponentially flat. And what one studies there is just the interaction, the Coulomb interaction between the brain and the anti-brain. After it turns out that after moduli stabilization, there are other one corrections to the eta parameter that are induced and that generically spoil the flatness of the potential. Yeah? So really, in order to prove whether inflation can occur or not, one is obliged to compute this with fixed moduli. Yeah? What people were hoping initially is that maybe this problem of moduli stabilization and computing the shape of the infinite potential, that problem would actually factorize. Yeah? But it turns out that, you know, that there's an important interaction between those two problems, and one has to do it simultaneously. Maybe I'm just going to skip over this a little bit. So one can ask about the different effects in a KKMT and compactification that acts on and has effects on D3 brains. A rather simple argument showed that fluxes, if they are of a specific type, yeah, if they are imaginary self-dual, don't have an effect on the D3 brains. Yeah? And so that's what we and most other people were assuming, that the flux, you know, the compactification is such that the fluxes satisfy this condition. If that's not the case, one can then ask what the forces on the brains will be. And that's actually something we're looking at right now. But okay, for the remainder of the talk, I want to assume that one can ignore the effects of fluxes. So then the second effect that KKLT uses is non-perturbative effects to stabilize the module, stabilize the volume. And one has to ask whether these inclusion of those effects has a back reacts on the shape of the potential. And it actually turns out that those effects can have dangerous order one corrections to the inflaton potential. And usually, you know, it's parameterized like this, where the non-perturbative superpotential has a prefactor and has an exponential dependence of the Kähler modulus. And the statement is that this prefactor is obliged to depend on the inflaton value. Yeah. And it's this dependence on the inflaton value that then affects the detailed shape of the potential. Okay. But I think there's also a nice physical and qualitative explanation for the different types of forces that the D3 fields in addition to the Coulomb interaction. So there are basically two obvious effects that lead to order one corrections to the eta parameter. So again, let me just remind you, the setting is like this. Yeah. So a brain and an anti-brain in a warped throat region. And what we are assuming now in addition is that there's a seven brain wrapping a four cycle. And that seven brain is required in order to stabilize the volume modulus. That or something like it. Yeah. So for concreteness here, I'm assuming a seven brain that reaches into the throat. And I would like, then in this setting, I would like to ask what the different forces are. So the first force that a three brain feels is because the first force basically arises if one drops the approximation that the brain is a probe object. Yeah? So that approximation is sufficient for a lot of calculations, but it turns out not to be sufficient for computing the inflaton potential. Yeah? So in order to, you know, to evaluate the delicate flatness of the potential, one has to actually treat this more carefully and drop the approximation that the brain is a probe. So if one and then, you know, associate some energy momentum tensor with that brain here, that energy momentum back reacts on the overall volume. Yeah? So I was mentioning this earlier a little bit. There's a small effect that as the D3 brain moves, the overall volume changes, just gravitationally. Yeah? So what that means is that the total 6 volume will depend on the implotent value. And then, but of course, we know when we go to from string to Einstein frame, the action will pick up factors of the overall volume, and those factors of the overall volume will then be reflected in a correction term to the potential. Yeah? And so that's in fact the term that was computed by KKLMT. Yeah? Although they phrase it a little bit differently. Okay, and then the second obvious effect one can worry about is interaction between the 3 brain and the 7 brain. Yeah. And what then happens is it's actually very similar in spirit to what I was just describing. The 3 brain again has energy momentum associated with it. What it does is it distorts the background geometry, and in particular it changes the warp factor at the location of the D7. And it turns out that the gauge coupling on the world volume of the D7 is proportional to the 4-dimensional volume at that location. So since the D3 drain perturbs the 4-dimensional volume, it changes the gauge coupling, effect gauge coupling on the D7 brain. And then the non-perturbative superpotential just depends on that volume in the following way. So this pre-factor effectively arises because the D3 brain back reacts on the 4-cycle geometry. Yeah. And again, this leads to a correction to the potential. And again, also that because although we phrase it differently, that's what we effectively come. Actually, we didn't phrase it differently. That's what we computed. Okay, so I pointed out 2 corrections: D3 back reaction on the volume, and then D3 D7 interaction. And then one can compute the effect on the eta parameter that the 2 effects have. And so the first effect, gives a constant 2/3 contribution. And that's what is meant is when one talks about the eta problem for this scenario, is that only having this force gives a constant shift to the eta parameter that automatically makes it large. Yeah? But what KKMT also realizes is that there is a second force, and that this second force could be of a functional type such that there could be a cancellation here. Yeah? But that was always an implicit assumption that was not proven because this function was unknown. Yeah? And so the question would be, can this eta parameter ever be small? So in order for the eta parameter to be small, there has to be a cancellation between the two. And this kind of, So the first thing that we could check after computing this function is, there are two simple checks. First check would be whether this function comes with the right sign. If this function, for example, always came with a plus sign, in the cases where it does, then it only makes the eta problem worse rather than solving anything. And second, even if it comes with the right sign, one has to, be able to show that it comes with the right magnitude also to allow cancellation. So those are 2 qualitative checks that one can do on this function after computing it. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I should be able to realize this additional correction in terms of deformation of the geometry. So you're saying that there will be a large correction to the geometry of the probe brain that will do this change.
Yeah, it doesn't even have to be such a large correction, I think, because it appears in an exponential here. So this is still this perturbation. So effectively, what happens is the warp factor here will be perturbed. Perturbation, the warp factor appears in the exponential of the superpotential. So even a small change there can have large effects. So I don't think it's true that this necessarily this geometry is widely perturbed. I think that would be problematic.
But I'm thinking from a four-dimensional perspective. The eta problem is more clear in the 10-dimensional perspective.
Okay.
And I'm saying in the 10-dimensional perspective, I should be able to rephrase the solution in terms of the deformation of the local geometry.
Okay,
all right.
I'd actually be very interested to talk about that, because that's something we're puzzled about right now when we talk thinking about these pluses also.
Yeah, my problem is that I don't see this.
Maybe I should make this clear. Here we're using a slight trick. Yeah. So this calculation, in some sense, is 10-dimensional, where we use the perturbation to the warp factor. Yeah. But then we use this 10-dimensional result, to relating it to an effective 4D parameter. It's a little bit a mix of these two languages. So I'd like to understand, actually, what we're trying to do is I'd like to understand these things purely so I said those things before in the interest of time. Skip over that. So So the point being is that, you know, naturally the potential isn't flat enough, although people were hoping that initially. One has to compute this function and ask those two simple questions that I mentioned. And so effectively that's what we did, is we computed this change in the warp volume of the four cycle. And in a separate paper, then we asked, you know, what that change implies for the actual shape of the potential. And it took us a while because the potential then often, you know, effectively depends on H real fields. So it's not that one computes this correction and, you know, it is handed with a nice effective 1D potential. The potential will depend on H real fields, basically five angles and one radial coordinate, and then a complexified volume. And one has to worry about, you know, evolution of all those fields simultaneously. So one has to stabilize the angles consistently, stabilize the volume consistently, while the inflaton is evolving. So what we found actually that it's very sensitive to doing this properly, I think. So what one could imagine is that's just one fixes by hand, you know, the overall volume and keeps it fixed for the whole evolution. It turns out that leads to delicate errors that are important if one wants to assess the shape in detail. So effectively, that's what we did, is we integrated out all the other fields by minimizing all the fields that weren't the radial evolution, and then looked at the radial instability as the moves.
Okay, but don't you worry about instabilities in other directions?
So what one has to prove is, it's a little bit of a, what one has to do is one has to look at the mass matrix of the angular directions. Yeah. And so that's what we did, and one has to prove that it's positive definite and all angular directions are actually stable, so that you're not evolving away from some big angular extremum. So we extremize the angles, shows that at the location of the extrema of the angles, the potential is stable and not unstable. And the only instability direction, and the same for the volume, and then the only instability direction is the radial direction, where the brain moves towards the thing.
So you make an assumption that the compact is fixed during the derivation of this?
No, not at all.
Otherwise you get wrong.
That's captured here.
Okay.
So this row effectively parameterizes the total overall size. Mm-hmm. And it's crucial. You get actually if you can try what happens if you do fix it, and you will see that it's the wrong approximation to make. Especially since, you know, although naively people thought, you know, maybe it doesn't matter much because the volume only shifts by 1% or 2%, but it's in an exponential again. So 1% change in an exponential, and that's why this was a little harder than we initially thought. We let the volume depend on the field, let the angles depend on the field, and evolve all of, and then compute the effective single field. So I'm almost there. So the effect, the potential will depend on the microscopic input parameters, and those microscopic parameters will be restricted by constraints on the compactification. So the four important parameters are the number of these seven grains. Yeah, so one can imagine more than one brain wrapping the four cycle. And then the minimal radius of the embedding. So the seven brain reaches some distance into the throat, and this minimal distance here is a furrow. Then the overall volume of the four cycle, and that receives again a contribution just from the throat region, this part, and then it receives a contribution from the bulk. And again, there will be a similar constraint as the constraint on the plank mass. Yeah, just by computing the volume from the from the throat region, and then the overall warping scale, yeah, which can be parameterized by the warp factor at the tip, or by this flux integer. So those are the four parameters. They can all be related to discrete, in principle, to discrete integer input. In practice, we use these effective parameters here, and then there are these three constraints: a constraint on the field range, a constraint on the four cycle volume. And again, a back reaction constraint that the number of the seven brains cannot be larger than the integer flux of the background.
I know you're running out of time, but I do have a question. So your other seven directions that you said were at positive mass, mm-hmm. Is their mass much bigger than Hubble, or can you use them to do perturbation, you know, these sort of
perturbations? There are two classes, I think. There's some that are actually, in our treatment, are isometries of the embedding. So if this C7 brain wasn't there, yeah. Then in the angular directions, it will be precisely flat. Yeah. So the seven brains break some of the isometries of the five-dimensional base. And those directions will receive masses in the angles. But then there are some symmetries of the base that aren't broken, and those directions will stay flat angular directions. One can estimate what happens when one glues these distorted into a bulk region, and generically you would also break those remaining isometries, yeah, and induce masses even in those directions. But those masses could be, in principle, could be smaller than H. Yeah. And I think people have started to think about whether isocurvature fluctuations in the angles can be important for the fluctuation spectrum. I don't think they're important they could also be important for the background evolution if the angles don't relax quick enough to the extremal values. So that's an important problem. I mean, to actually look at the angles, the magnitude of the mass matrix for the angles. Mm-hmm. So in principle, we could have done that, but somehow we ran out of strength of the maximizing eight fields. So what I want to imagine now is fixing three of them, just for simplicity, and change and playing with changing one of those parameters. And so effectively, what the geometric picture would be just shifting this position of the D7 brain in and out of this row. And then what I want to show next is plots of the effective potential per row. Making this geometric shift. And the first thing one finds is that for generic parameters, for random parameters, one finds this metastable behavior. Yeah? Where the interim field is actually stabilized at a finite value of R. Yeah? So that's what happens on fixtures. Non-tuned inauditory parameters, then that's the generic shape. But what one also finds is that when one changes this continuously, this metastable feature gets more and more shallow. And in particular, at some point, the behavior changes and it becomes monotonic. Yeah? So what that means, of course, is that first of all, there's always a point where the eta problem is locally solved by fine-tuning, because the eta is zero at these, the second derivative of the potential is zero at these points. And then at the transition from metastable to monotonic, also the first derivative is zero at that transition point. So there's a very fine-tuned point where both the first and the second derivative are actually vanishing. And then around that point, the first two slow roll parameters are.
What is little n?
Little what?
Little n. You said that you fix little n and you vary.
Yeah, little n is the number of the seven rates.
So on your plots, what is the value of little n?
Oh, it's just, I think on the plots it's just two or three. It turns out it's very insensitive actually to little n. So you could pick the most conservative would just be a small number where you don't have to worry much about that reaction. I think even n of one might be special, but n, 2, 3, 4. All look pretty much the same.
It's a little bit hard to,
we can talk about that. Yeah, this parameter S is an effective parameter which combines some of these.
The E3 brain evolution is far away from the G4 seventh brain.
So the throat ends, you can see that the throat ends at roughly at, or here I express it as a ratio of the position of the D3 position and the D7 position. Mm-hmm. So this one, this is halfway, roughly this feature appears halfway between this point and the tip.
So D7 cannot be a probe, because if it is a probe, then I still tell if the 10-dimensional perspective is a probe. Uh-huh. You would agree with that. I cannot read the D3 brain, so it traps the cycle, it stabilizes moduli, but I cannot treat it as a probe, because if I do, then the local geometry of the D3 brain is not changed. And so you get 8 2/3 plus.
Oh, I see, yeah, okay.
So you took into account the back reaction of the D3 in your analysis?
Yeah. Well, I think that was the point. That's where the second force is coming from. It's coming from a back reaction of the D3. I agree, if you don't take that into account, either, yeah. Well, if you take the D7 and move it far outside of the throat. Yeah. So this is also a rather specific setup where the D7 actually reaches into the throat.
So if tuning, presumably.
Yeah, that's a discrete choice of, but yeah. For two reasons. The first reason is that if the D7 wasn't reaching into the throat, one wouldn't have a way of computing this effect. Yeah, that's just for simplicity. But then one can actually show in that if one removes the D7, that one continuously also removes that force. So it wouldn't help to put a D7 somewhere in the blood equation. So the only way of even having a chance of canceling this two-thirds is having the D7 reaching into the throat. Okay. So this is just, you know, again, just magnifying, you know, one of these very fine-tuned. You know, the only way of getting the inflation in that kind of setup is by having a special feature locally. Yeah. So the shape of the potential is actually steep out here and steep down here, and just locally for a small range of phi values, the potential is sufficient. Yeah. And one thing, of course, we initially worry about is that, you know, what if the field starts out here? And although the slow roll analysis tells you that the field will be inflating here, in reality it wouldn't, because you know there's a large phi dot contribution that comes from rolling down a steep hill.
So for this potential, do you know where phi has to start? Is there like a range
for? Yeah. So it a little bit depends. So if you just assume canonical kinetic term without DVI effect, then you have to start pretty close to the inflection point. But I believe there was actually a paper last week that, you know, allows this field to start anywhere. Uses basically the DBI slowdown to explain why the field is slow at that point. And so and that's a paper right on the way. So what he actually finds is that including DBI into the dynamical analysis allows you to field to start almost anywhere up here. Which seems like a very strong effect, but
so I guess it's hard to tell from this, but somehow there's a slight tilt that's pushing the field down.
Yeah, this has to be positive. Yeah.
And do you know that's like the so you expect some dispersion from just quantum fluctuations, right? Because you're in the city space.
Yeah.
So do you know that's subdominant force from it's pushing this down?
Well, that's guaranteed. I think as soon as you can fix the density normalization, that the rover will. That effectively amounts to also that's equivalent to the ratio of quantum fluctuations to classical loading. So I think as soon as you can fix the density spectrum, you're also good in terms of using the classical evolution. And then of course again, we did check. Okay. I should mention people should be free to leave. So I want to point out one curiosity about this inflection point feature, which is if you want to, you know, calculate the scalar spectrum, then there's actually no there's no strict prediction about whether the scalar spectral index will be red or blue. Yeah. And that's because what one has to do is one has to start from the end of inflation, yeah, which is about here. So you start from the end of inflation and go back 60 e folds. But then depending on the flatness of the potential, 60 e folds will occur either, you know, to the left or to the right of the inflection point. And the curvature of the potential will be, you know, have opposite signs. So if the 60 e-fold mark, you know, happens on this side, you know, the scalar spectrum will be blue. Okay. And if the 60 e-fold mark happens to this side, the scalar spectrum will be red. Okay. And a convenient parameter to parameterize this tuning is the total number of e-folds. So actually, it turns out that in the slow roll analysis, the total number of e-folds that this potential supports is finite, of course, because the potential is steep here and it's steep here. So in between, you have a finite number of total e-folds. Yeah. And so in order to solve the horizon problem, you need 60 e-folds, a minimum of 60 e-folds of inflation. But then you can show if you have only 60 e-folds, then your NS value is 3. Yeah. Because the 60 e-folds marks is right at the boundary here where the eta parameter is 1. Yeah. So what one actually requires is one requires an additional tuning. Yeah, beyond the simple tuning that is required to solve the horizon problem in order to make it clear that the scalar spectrum scale. So in fact, you know, if you have 120 total e-folds here, the 60 e-fold masses are exactly halfway, yeah. And this spectrum is scaled invariant. And then everything beyond that, you know, takes this particular shape. So I think this is another concern, you know, for a potential shape like this, that the scalar spectrum, first of all, is not uniquely defined. Yeah. And the simplest.
Even if you put it to be 0.96, don't you have significant running?
No, actually, you can. So actually, from this parameterization, you get this you know, in fact, analytic expression for NS value. So you could just compute the running from this as a second derivative, and then the running is large here. again, in the range that would anyway be ruled out by NS measurements. But here the running becomes small. So I checked that the running everywhere where the potential, the scalar spectrum is red, the running is also small. Okay, so let me just make a few critical remarks. We see that this scenario is very fine-tuned and delicate, and that inflation can only occur in a local range of phi values where the potential where there's a cancellation between two forces. And I just mentioned that the scalar invariant scalar spectrum requires extra Turing not required by a solution to the Riesz problem. And then there might be initial conditions and overshoot problems, but these two papers claim that these can be somehow alleviated. I'm happy to discuss those. And then the model also, of course, lacks a truly honest embedding into a compactification. Yeah. So far, this throat limit is still a non-compact limit where compactification effects are treated a little bit indirectly. What one could imagine is that when one glues this throat into a bulk region, there could be perturbations to the geometry coming from the UV. And what we're trying to estimate at the moment is how generic perturbations in the UV get propagated into the throat region. Yeah. Okay. Sorry for holding on this long. Right. I apologize. So this is basically, let that be my conclusion slide. So what I want to conclude is I pointed out three problems in inflationary cosmology that I think scream out for UV completion. So the first problem is actually proving that inflation can occur and that the problem is solved. And so what a satisfactory theory must come with sufficient degree of UV completeness to estimate all corrections. And what I pointed out was that the dangerous corrections are the ones that give an order one corrections to the curvature of the potential. Because that's typically the correction that is hardest to control. The second thing I pointed out is that gravitational waves, in order to see them, requires that the field evolves over a super Planckian distance. And although there seems to be no problem with that in effective field theory, to date there hasn't been an explicit realization of this in string theory. And maybe that just means we haven't been lucky so far, or it means that there's some more general principle to be found. And then the final thing, which I, for the lack of time, didn't talk about too much, is non-Gaussian entity. Turns out in the simplest single field models, non-Gaussian entity can only be large if higher derivative terms, a number of higher derivative terms play a crucial role during inflation. And of course, this requires an implausible UV completion of those correction terms to the kinetic term. And DBI is one example where that is. Where that is maybe realized. So thank you very much. I'm sorry for you.
And Daniel is going to be with us for the next couple of weeks. I suggest you restrict personal questions and private questions later on. Let's thank him again.